But the analyst told him this would be impossible, because much of the information in the book came from black propaganda the CIA themselves had invented to smear the Soviet Union. They knew that the terror network didn't exist, because they themselves had made it up.
And when we looked through the book, we found very clear episodes where CIA black propaganda, clandestine information that was designed under a covert action plan to be planted in European newspapers, were picked up and put in this book.
Melvin Goodman, head of the CIA Office of Soviet Affairs, 1976 to 1987.
A lot of it was made up, right? It was made up out of whole cloth.
You told him this?
We told him that, point blank. And we even had the operations people to tell Bill Casey this. I thought maybe this might have an impact, but all of us were dismissed. Casey had made up his mind. He knew the Soviets were involved in terrorism, so there was nothing we could tell him to disabuse him. Lies became reality.
In the end, Casey found a university professor who described himself as a terror expert. And he produced a dossier that confirmed that the hidden terror network did in fact exist. Under such intense lobbying, Reagan agreed to give the neoconservatives what they wanted. And in 1983, he signed a secret document that fundamentally changed American foreign policy. The country would now fight covert wars to push back the hidden Soviet threat around the world.
The specter of Marxist-Leninist-controlled governments with ideological and political loyalties to the Soviet Union poses a direct challenge to which we must respond. They are the focus of evil in the modern world.
It was a triumph for the neoconservatives. America was now setting out to do battle against the forces of evil in the world. But what had started out as the kind of myth that Leo Strauss had said was necessary for the American people increasingly came to be seen as the truth by the neoconservatives. They began to believe their own fiction. They had become what they called democratic revolutionaries, who were going to use force to change the world.
We were aiming for an expansion of the zone of freedom in the world.
Michael Ledeen.
And in part that had to do with fighting communism, and in part it had to do with fighting other kinds of tyrannies. But that's what we were about. It's what we're still about.
And when you say you were democratic revolutionaries, what do you mean?
It meant that we wanted to support people who wanted to carry out revolutions against tyrannical regimes in the name of democracy in order to install a democratic system.
As simple as that.
Yeah, it's not nuclear physics, you know. I mean, freedom is a fairly simple thing to get.
It's a chancy job. Makes a man watchful and a little lonely. But somebody has to do it.
The neoconservatives now set out to transform the world. In next week's episode, they find themselves joining forces with the Islamists in Afghanistan. And together, they fight an epic battle against the Soviet Union. And both come to believe that they had defeated the evil empire. But this imagined victory would leave them without an enemy. And in a world disillusioned with grand political ideas, they would need to invent new fantasies and new nightmares in order to maintain their power.
And you've been listening to a radio adaptation of the documentary The Power of Nightmares, The Rise of the Politics of Fear, Part 1, Baby, It's Cold Outside, written and directed by Adam Curtis. Next week, Part 2. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner, Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
In January you still got the choice. You can cut the weeds before they start to bud. If you leave them to grow high, they'll silence your voice, and in December you may pay with your blood. So close your eyes, stop your ears, close your mouth, take it slow. Let others take the lead and you bring up the rear. And later you can say you didn't know. Every day another vulture takes flight. There's another danger born every morning. In the darkness of your blindness, the beast will learn to bite. How can you fight if you can't recognize a warning? So close your eyes, stop your ears, close your mouth, take it slow. Let others take the lead and you bring up the rear. And later you can say you didn't know.
Hundreds of Ohio voters told of having been denied their franchise by misinformed poll workers, malfunctioning voting machines, mysterious clerical errors, and outright intimidation and misdirection. What follows is a montage of some of their testimonies.
At least 30 voters, after voting, came over to our stand and complained to us that they felt harassed by poll workers who kept yelling, "You only get 5 minutes, vote." In 4 different cases, I personally took people back into the polling place because they came out after waiting 2 to 3 hours and reported to us that they were not permitted to vote.
When I arrived in Reynoldsburg, Ohio, to vote, precinct D, I was told immediately, I mean, everyone else is walking in and out, no ID, but I was told immediately that I was on a predetermined list that I was to be challenged. I was asked for my ID, and upon showing the lady my ID, she said, "Well, I'm sorry, you won't be able to vote today." She then asked me if I had a utility bill, and the only thing I had was my driver's license, and I had printed off a copy of my voter's registration from the Franklin County Board of Elections, which I have here. I showed her my voter's registration. She said, "No, that wasn't good enough. I needed a utility bill." I left the line, went out, searched my car for anything. I didn't have a bill, and most people wouldn't. I then called the Franklin County Auditor because I just paid $500. And I asked him, fortunately, I was voting at a school, I asked him if he would fax me a receipt. And I went in, asked the school office if they would let me receive a fax. So I got a faxed bill from Franklin County Auditor, and the lady looked at that, looked at my ID, looked at my registration, and said, again for the third time, she was sorry that I wouldn't be able to vote. I could go home. I wasn't offered a provisional ballot or anything.
I can tell you this, we bought pizzas for people. We bought lots and lots of water, snacks. And at 7:30, there were at least 150 people sitting in the auditorium still waiting to vote. On the 4 machines they had, we figured that they could handle about 41 people an hour.
I pushed John Kerry, and my vote immediately jumped up to George Bush. After I started screaming about them cheating again, the aide hurried up and came over and said, "Oh, that's been happening a lot. Just go on and push John Kerry again." And I'm saying, "You say that's been happening a lot and it hasn't been corrected?" "Yes, but we can't do anything about it."
Once it was my turn, I got inside and looked over the voting machine. And this was one of the electronic voting machines. It consisted of an array of blinking lights urging you to vote for something, and once you did vote for something, the blinking light would go out and a steady red light would appear next to your selection. On the upper left-hand part was the selection for president. I wanted to do this. I wanted to get this out of the way. That's what I came here to vote. That was my number one priority. So I pushed the button for John Kerry for president of the United States, and the flashing light went out, and the light next to John Kerry's name came on. I then mulled over the rest of the propositions and local races. Once I was finished, I got down to the lower right-hand corner, and the big green vote button was beckoning. I almost pushed it, and I said, "No, wait a minute. I want to proofread what I just did. I want to look over my selections." I looked up into the upper left-hand corner, and area for president of the United States was now flashing again. My vote for John Kerry had been neutralized. It had been reset. Now, you can call this a glitch. You can call this a design flaw. You can call it a bologna sandwich if you want. But whatever you call it, that machine nearly threw out and neutralized my vote for John Kerry. The thing I want to know is, what are we going to do about it? Because if we don't do something about this, I fear that the foundation of our very democracy, voting, is in peril.
In Franklin County, where voters in traditionally Democratic, urban and African-American, Latino, and working-class neighborhoods waited in line for an average of nearly 3 hours at the polling places, while in the affluent suburbs the waits were short or inconsequential, it became apparent that the number of voting machines assigned to each polling place was an issue.
Our volunteers arrived at the polling places between 6:50 and 7 p.m., 30 to 40 minutes before the polls closed, expecting to find long lines stretching out of the building. Instead, they were astonished to find poll workers in virtually vacant buildings standing around with nothing to do. In the course of the next half hour, the few people that came in to vote were on their way home within minutes. Because each of the four voting areas is located within a mile of each other, I drove to each of them between 6:50 and 7 p.m. and saw for myself that no lines existed at any of the polling places in our ward. How could this be possible? Upper Arlington, like the rest of Franklin County, had a huge turnout of voters. Approximately 71% of registered voters in UA had shown up to vote, an increase of 12% over the 2000 election. Yet at the end of the day, no lines existed. Back home at 8 p.m., I watched on TV how some areas of Franklin County still had long lines of people that were going to have to wait hours to vote. This could not have been an accident. In my affluent, predominantly Republican community, where 62% of the people voted for George Bush in the 2000 election, lines were not a problem. In Ward 6, where I worked, every precinct had three or four voting machines, which works out to one voting machine for every 164 people who voted. Yet, late on election night, the news programs continued to show people in Franklin County and other parts of the state waiting in line to vote hours after the polls had closed. It appeared that these lines were primarily in low-income, student, or minority communities, areas that consist predominantly of Democratic voters.
Sure.
The only conclusion I can draw from this is there was an intentional effort to usher Republican voters through relatively short lines to ensure they cast their vote, while creating excessively long lines in Democratic areas to suppress their right to vote by ensuring some people would leave without voting because they were incapable of standing in lines for 3 or 4 hours long or they had to get to work.
Those were some of the voices of Ohio voters testifying at public hearings following the November election, assembled by Evan Davis, reporting for TUC Radio. Among the hearings held last month concerning the election were those of Representative John Conyers, ranking minority member of the House Judiciary Committee, who took testimony and reviewed evidence of election fraud and misconduct in Ohio. On December 30th, William Rivers Pitt reported in his online news service, Truthout, that Conyers will object to the counting of the Ohio electors from the 2004 presidential election when Congress convenes to ratify those votes on January 6th. In a letter dispatched to every senator, which will be officially published by his office shortly, Conyers declares that he will be joined in this by several other members of the House. As you know, writes Conyers in his letter, on January 6, 2005 at 1 p.m., the electoral votes for the election of the president are to be opened and counted in a joint session of Congress. I and a number of House members are planning to object to the counting of the Ohio votes due to the numerous unexplained irregularities in the Ohio presidential vote, many of which appear to violate both federal and state law. The letter goes on to ask the senators who receive this letter to join Conyers in objecting to the Ohio electors. Writes Conyers, I will shortly forward you a draft report itemizing and analyzing the many irregularities we have come across as part of our hearings and investigation into the Ohio presidential election. Last week, two Columbus-area journalists, Evan Davis and Bob Fetrakis, spoke with Indy Media On Air about some of what has been uncovered.
Chris Burnett in the studio with me, Stephen Starr. We are on the telephone with Bob Fetrakis, the editor-in-chief, or the editor of the Columbus Free Press, and Evan Davis, Pacifica correspondent. Evan and Bob are in Ohio, the site of some massive questions about the veracity of the election in November, and it seems that evidence is mounting that there was corruption at the highest level, and perhaps the recount has also been tainted.
What's really at stake here in Ohio, I mean, something's infinitely more important than whether John Kerry or George Bush wins the election. It's the great institution of democracy is on trial before the American people, and that what Lincoln had spoken about in the Gettysburg Address, government of the people, by the people, and for the people, whether or not it will perish from this earth, is really what was on my mind that day, because I absolutely believe if you allow private, secret, corporate vendors to tell you who won elections with no paper trail, with complete lack of transparency, then essentially democracy is dead in the United States.
So, Bob, what's going on this week? What are the details that are bringing these issues up now?
Well, there's a variety of details. For example, this morning, Secretary of State Ken Blackwell, who also serves as the Bush-Cheney reelection committee chair in Ohio, the co-chair of Bush-Cheney reelection, refused to show up for a deposition. I'm one of the three attorneys that has filed a lawsuit to challenge the election results in Ohio because we believe that the election exit polls are correct. Remember that the consortium election polls, which have a very small margin of error, showed John Kerry winning with 51% of the vote. The Zogby poll showed John Kerry winning with 53% of the vote. Note that the challenger in the Ukraine was shown winning with 54% of the vote, and the U.S. government demanded a revote. And we have similar results here in Ohio. I believe that John Kerry, in fact, won the election based on the exit polls, and that there is evidence of widespread tampering throughout Ohio with results that if anyone took 5 minutes and just looked at them, would say that those results are fraudulent or are wrong because of accident or error.
What kind of evidence are we looking at? Like maybe a couple of examples.
Yeah. Well, we could go to Miami County where we have a screenshot with 100% of the votes reporting, and then an additional 19,000 votes come in at the exact same ratio for Kerry and Bush. We have a county in South Concord where they claimed everyone but 10 people voted, where there was a 98.55% voter turnout. And Evan's initial canvass has already found 25 people that say that they did not vote. So when you look at these vote totals, particularly in the Bush areas, some people say computer glitch, software glitch, or computer malfunction, but it looks like somebody was visibly tampering with the vote. I mean, in Gahanna Ward 1B, 638 people cast votes for president. The president got 4,258 votes. I mean, they've now corrected that. We believe that there's far more errors throughout Ohio. Many of these are in Democratic wards where machines, where Kerry should have been carrying 70 to 30, suddenly there's a minus 25 million votes. Virtually all of the areas affect the Kerry votes. In a district in Cleveland, where Kerry was winning 97.5%, in an African-American area, they claim only 7.1% of the people turned out to vote. So in the Democratic areas, you'll see these really low vote totals, but in the Republican areas, you'll see precincts where they claim 98.55% of the people voted. I think by accident, error, or in some cases, deliberate human intervention, votes were, in fact, added to Bush and subtracted from Kerry.
And then we get to the recount itself. And tell us about Cheryl Eaton.
Well, I mean, you've got the election worker there in Hocking County. And saying, look, Triad comes in. Triad is in 41 counties. They're a private company here that assists in voting software and with central tabulators. A lot of these are all private companies. For example, Diebold in Lucas County, where Toledo is, leases the machines and the software. It's all trade secrets. Nobody knows what's in their secret software. ES&S, another Republican-connected firm. The predecessor company, AIS, was actually partly owned by Republican Senator Chuck Hagel, who has ties to the Bush family, particularly the Bush the Elder. He organized the G7 forum. So you've got all these private companies all over the state, of which Triad is in 41 counties. And essentially, when it came time to recount, these companies went in and pretty much handled and orchestrated the recounts. The recounts are supposed to be done randomly. That means any ballot has the same chance of being included. But usually what happened in Lucas County and is with Diebold and with Triad, they knew in advance what ballots were going to be recounted, and they went in and reprogrammed the machines in order to get a perfect recount. And that's not what you're looking for. You're looking for a random recount to see if there's any evidence of fraud or error.
Well, Cheryl Eaton does an affidavit where she says that a member of Triad came in and explained to her how to post a cheat sheet on the wall so the count would come out perfect and they wouldn't have to do a full-hand recount of the county. Is that correct?
Actually, I can answer to that because I interviewed both the technician who posted that alleged cheat sheet and Cheryl Eaton. And there is, if you don't dig too deeply, there's a logical explanation for that. The precincts that were selected for that recount had a certain number of what they call overvotes and undervotes, that is, ballots that don't have the proper number of chads punched out or that have too many of the chads punched out. And those are insignificant numbers. They're just a few per precinct generally. And in this case, in order for the hand count to match the machine tally, the technician wanted the people who would be engaged in the hand count to know how many undervotes or overvoted ballots to look for. Now, there's some accuracy in calling that a cheat sheet, because technically that's not information that either the person operating the machine tally or the hand counters should necessarily know in advance. It was information gleaned from the initial machine tabulation. There was, however, the implication that the technician was suggesting that the hand counters would want to adjust their hand tally to reflect those numbers in order to make the hand count match the machine count. And that's critical because only if the hand count and the machine counts do not match after two successive tries, does the law intervene and require that a full 100% hand count of all of the ballots in that county take place?
Well, it certainly prompted 100%. It prompted Conyers, the ranking House Judiciary Committee member, senior Democrat John Conyers, to accuse Brett Rapp, the boss of Triad Systems, of orchestrating a criminal conspiracy to pervert the outcome of the Ohio recount.
Right. Under Ohio law, the law requires a random recount. And it raises another question. Why can't the county officials who run the Board of Election pick the ballots and run them through a machine to recount them? Why do they need private corporate vendors who overwhelmingly in this case, and in the case of Diebold and ES&S, are Republican partisans? It seems absurd that you would be allowing private corporations with secret software to essentially tell you who won the election. In fact, two counties, when we asked them for their election results, simply forwarded letters from their vendors telling us what the vote count was. I mean, we've privatized the vote counting, and these corporations that count the vote secretly, partisans of President Bush.
Did Kerry file for expedited discovery on the 23rd?
What Kerry specifically asked for was that these machines be impounded, and he sent a letter, 11-point inquiry. He has specific concerns, and he particularly referenced New Mexico as well, with these Diebold and these OptiScan machines, because it seems like where these machines are, they don't reflect the demographics of Democrats and Republicans. So what he wanted is to look at the machines, to have them impounded, to have forensic computer experts pore over them and make sure they're calibrated correctly. In Sylvania Ward 3 in Lucas County, which is where Toledo is, when they brought out the memory cards to do the recount, they found that the card in place on Election Day had not been programmed and needed to be reprogrammed. Two memory cards in Franklin County from an e-voting machine, a computer voting machine, gave error codes essentially saying that they could not be read from Election Day. So why are these widespread problems, and why doesn't anybody know what's wrong with them, and why can't Mr. Kerry or, for example, the people challenging these elections look at these machines and find out what's wrong with them?
John Conyers will be, or is expected, on the 6th of January to take a certain stand on Capitol Hill. Bob, could you tell us about that?
What Representative John Conyers has pledged to do is that when the Electoral College meets, those of you who saw Fahrenheit 911, is that he will attempt to challenge the Ohio electors, the ones that were certified, in question and to openly debate the election results in Ohio. There's 35 states that were sort of more or less in play, but particularly there were 11 battleground states. And in 10 of those, you had abnormal results. So I think if people begin to look at these exit polls, in three states alone, that is Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, is the exit polls all fell significantly, and that is more than three standard deviations, I mean, which is massively unlikely. It's so unlikely that these exit polls would be so wrong and all in the favor of President Bush. It makes it sort of like hitting the mega lotto and the super lotto on the same night. In fact, an initial analysis from Ron Behman, a statistician at the University of Illinois, puts the odds of these polls being so wrong outside the margin of error in these three key battleground states as 155 million to one. That, again, that means you flip a coin and it comes up heads 155 million times before it comes up tails. Thank God that John Conyers is willing to raise these questions.
If we're talking about an Electoral College standoff around what happened in some of the key battleground states, give us a timeline of process of what actually happens.
Well, there'll be a two-hour discussion with the retirement to both houses. But if you begin to look at the voting irregularities, they occurred in 10 out of 11 battleground states, and also may have occurred in as many as 35 states. So if there is a ripple effect, we could be debating, we could be postponing the inauguration.
And I would say even locally here in Ohio and elsewhere, if local litigations, such as the contest of election here in Ohio, produce a court-ordered investigation, which would include a hand recount, then that process, too, will take quite some time. It takes quite a bit longer to recount the ballots by hand than electronically. And so we might even find ourselves in the thick of a discovery process on January 6th, which would effectively hold up the results or at least call them into question.
One question I want to ask both of you is, you know, we have this situation with Kerry conceding immediately, and a lot of people felt that, you know, this man is, A, doesn't really represent working people's interest, is in many ways was very spineless for just giving up in that, you know, so quickly. You know, the fact that the Kerry administration probably, in terms of the U.S. foreign policy in Iraq, would not have changed. It's really hard to, in many ways, for my gut to get behind, you know, this whole Kerry thing. And I recognize, Bob, that you say that what's really at stake here is more fundamental than that. It's a principle of democracy that, you know, we can't let them get away with this. In the bigger picture of what's actually happening, I'd like you to respond to that. And also, you know, what's to prevent the Supreme Court from just stepping in again and giving the election to Bush?
Well, I think the bigger picture here, and I say this as someone who's written a book called Spooks, Nukes, and Nazis, is that on a much grander scale, the United States rigged elections all over the Third World in the 1970s and 80s. In fact, the Church Committee by former Senator Frank Church of Idaho documented hundreds and hundreds of these so-called benign operations. That's because they didn't have to kill people. There were many operations during the Cold War where, you know, tens of thousands of people died. Now, this goes more to the question of what type of society America is going to be. Essentially, I believe what used to be done covertly in the Third World is being brought home, and that the privatization of these elections and the destruction of the democratic process, and this extends beyond John Kerry, this extends to how difficult it is to get third-party candidates on the ballot, whether it's Ralph Nader or Mr. Cobb or a Libertarian candidate, is that what you're seeing essentially is the demise of a range of opinions. And as long as we allow private corporations to control our vote, we'll never have any form of real democracy, whether it's for a shallow, gutless, and soulless Democratic Party giving little opposition, or the new voices that need to emerge. What people need to think about this, my dad was a Teamster. When you had someone come down to Teamster Hall, you know, like Jimmy DeWeasel, and he grabbed the ballot box and took it in the back room and counted it and then shredded every bit of paper and came out and announced who won, people knew there was a corruption. You now have the exact same thing. You have electronic voting machines with no paper trails, run by partisan supporters of President Bush and the Republican Party, without a paper trail, telling you to accept on faith who won the election, even as the machines jump from Kerry to Bush, even as the machines show 638 people voting and 4,258 votes for the president. What is at stake here goes well beyond John Kerry. What is at stake here is whether in the future we will have transparency and we can actually trust the vote in the United States, or whether people long associated with the CIA, long associated with the military-industrial complex, are now conducting what they themselves call demonstration elections. That is, bogus election with predetermined outcome and predetermined policy results that make us feel good about ourselves but have nothing to do with real democracy.
And the Supreme Court.
Oh, the Supreme Court. I mean, they may do it again, but I think that's good. The more you can force this Supreme Court to show that it's an undemocratic force, the more democracy and the people will take other forms of action. I mean, ultimately, demonstration and protesting in the street has worked far better for the Ukraine than relying upon a court that is, of course, conservative and appointed for life and with direct ties to reactionary forces.
Journalists Bob Fetrakis and Evan Davis from Ohio speaking with KPFK's Indie Media on air. When Congress convenes on January 6th to ratify the Electoral College ballots, at least 13 members of the House of Representatives, including Representative Louise Slaughter of Rochester, will challenge the validity of the Ohio election results. In order for their challenge to proceed, they must be joined by at least one senator. Thus far, as in 2000, no senators have committed to joining the challenge. And organizations of voters who believe the election was rigged are urging people to contact their senators before January 6th and demand they stand up with John Conyers and the others. For more information on this effort, visit contestthevote.org. And to send an electronic letter, visit thedeanpeople.org, thedeanpeople.org. To see documentation from the lawsuit contesting the Ohio election, visit freepress.org. Finally, we'll take an in-depth look at the significance of the discrepancy between the exit polls and the official election results. Counting and recounting cannot uncover fraud where the original votes have been electronically deleted or altered, nor where cards have been pre-punched or machines pre-programmed. For example, voters in Trumbull County, Ohio, have testified that on Election Day they received punch card ballots where holes were already punched for Bush. Meanwhile, a notarized affidavit signed by Angela Green, who voted at Whitehall Yearling High School in Central Ohio's Franklin County, stated that one of the malfunctioning electronic voting machines at her polling place was delivered without a cartridge, meaning votes cast might have gone unrecorded. And recounting can't address the issue of likely Kerry voters being discouraged by the conduct of the election itself. Ohio Secretary of State Kenneth Blackwell, who was also the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign in Ohio, was responsible for conducting the election and giving orders to all election workers in the state through his chain of command. Among Blackwell's powers as Secretary of State was to determine how many voting machines to deliver to each precinct. Voter registration records make it clear which precincts have majority Republican or Democratic registrants on the voter rolls, so a partisan official like Blackwell is in a position to use that knowledge to help his candidate. In an article published in the Columbus Free Press by Bob Fitrakis, who you just heard interviewed, he reported that, quote, "The Free Press has also obtained a list of all voting machines assigned in Franklin County, including serial numbers. The list contains at least 42 machines originally assigned to the predominantly African-American and inner-city wards that voted 80% for Kerry, and where voters waited in line for 3 hours or more on Election Day. These 42 machines were blacked out on the list, raising the question of whether these were among the 68 machines the Franklin County Board of Elections has admitted holding back in the warehouse, despite obvious shortages at certain polling places. Affidavits from poll workers confirm that numerous requests for more machines were made through Election Day, but that few, if any, were delivered. On December 28th, two scholars, Jonathan D. Simon, J.D., of Verified Vote 2004, and Dr. Ron P. Bayman of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, released a study titled, "The 2004 Presidential Election, Who Won the Popular Vote? An Examination of the Comparative Validity of Exit Poll and Vote Count Data." I'm going to read you their report. They wrote, "Although it is the Electoral College and not the popular vote that legally elects the president, winning the popular vote does have considerable psychological and practical significance. It is fair to say, to take a recent example, that had Al Gore not enjoyed a popular vote margin in 2000, he would not have had standing in the court of public opinion to maintain his post-election challenge for more than a month up until its ultimate foreclosure by the Supreme Court. In the 2004 election, now under scrutiny, the popular vote again has played a critical role. George Bush's apparent margin of 3.3 million votes clearly influenced the timing of John Kerry's concession. Although the election was once again close enough that yet-to-be-counted votes offered at least the mathematical possibility of a Kerry Electoral College victory, and although once again concerns about vote counting were beginning to emerge from early post-election reports and analyses, Kerry apparently believed that unlike popular vote winner Gore, he did not have effective standing to prolong the race. As ongoing inquiries continue to raise serious vote counting issues, Bush's apparent popular vote margin has loomed large as a rationale for minimizing these issues, at least as far as their impact on the outcome of the race. While much concern has been expressed about counting every vote, even the Kerry camp has issued disclaimers to the effect that their candidate does not expect that so doing will alter the outcome. With the results in Ohio currently subject to both recount proceedings and legal contest, dramatic developments compelling a reversal of the Ohio result cannot be ruled out at this time. Yet to overturn the Ohio result, giving Kerry an electoral college victory, or even to disqualify the Ohio electors via challenges in Congress, which would deprive Bush of an electoral college majority and throw the election into the House of Representatives, would likely be regarded as unjust and insupportable by a populace convinced that Bush was, by some 3.3 million votes, the people's choice. Thus, although the popular vote does not legally determine the presidency, its significance is such that we must give due consideration to any evidence which puts the popular vote count itself at issue. As the analysis which we undertake below is based upon the conflict between two sets of numbers, one generated by the exit polls for the presidential race, and the other generated by the vote counting equipment, it is necessary to review the nature of the two sources of results. Exit polling, since its invention several decades ago, has performed reliably in the projection of thousands of races, both here at home and more recently abroad. The record of exit polling from the 1970s through the 1990s was essentially free of controversy, except for the complaint that publication of exit poll results prior to poll closings dampened voter turnout by discouraging late-in-the-day voters from bothering to vote, the race having already been called. Voters could be so influenced because they had come indeed to regard exit poll projections as all but infallible. Significant exit polling problems began to appear along with the development and spread of computerized vote counting equipment, since which time exit polls have had a notably poorer track record in spite of improvements in polling methodology. Compared to standard pre-election polling, exit polling has certain advantages and disadvantages. On the plus side, exit polls sample actual rather than just likely voters and do not fail to include voters who are not attached to a conventional phone line or who screen their calls. This results in significantly greater accuracy. On the minus side, exit polls employ a cluster sampling technique, grouping respondents by precinct, rather than a fully homogenized random sample of the target venue. This results in somewhat less accuracy. On the whole, the advantages in accuracy an exit poll enjoys over a pre-election poll of the same sample size tend to outweigh the disadvantages. The exit polling in election 2004 was performed by the combined firms of Mitofsky International and Edison Media Research under exclusive contract as official provider of exit poll data to six major media organizations: CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, Fox News Channel, and the Associated Press, which collectively formed the National Election Pool. Exit polling operations were under the principal direction of Warren Mitofsky, credited as the inventor of exit polling and recognized throughout the world as the leading expert in the field. With over 35 years of exit polling experience, encompassing nearly 3,000 electoral contests in the United States and abroad, Mitofsky has achieved consistent success in the field and has continued throughout his career to refine and improve the methodologies and protocols of exit polling. In 1999, Mitofsky received the Award for Lifetime Achievement from the American Association for Public Opinion Research. Election 2004 presented a particular challenge and opportunity for Mr. Mitofsky, whose exit polling operation was hampered in 2002 by massive computer breakdown. It has been reported that preparations for election 2004 were especially thorough, entailing increased staff numbers and training, upgraded computer hardware and software, expanded surveys of absentee and early voters, and dry runs beginning in July to prepare analysts for the full spectrum of possible election night scenarios. It may be fairly said that the exit polling for election 2004 was a more advanced, sophisticated, and meticulous operation than any previously undertaken. In contrast to the uniform methodology of the exit polls, a variety of methods are employed to record votes on election day, including optical scan devices, direct electronic recording, DREs, or touchscreens, punch cards, paper ballots, lever machines, and data point devices in that order of prevalence. An additional variety of methods are then employed to transmit these votes to central locations and tally them at the county and state levels. Ownership and operation of this mosaic of machinery is fully privatized and is concentrated predominantly in the hands of four corporations, Diebold, ES&S, Sequoia, and Hart InterCivic. The partisan proclivities and activities of each of these corporations are a matter of public record. Because of the proprietary nature of the election system throughout the United States, these vendors of voting equipment design, program, operate, maintain, and repair it at every level, most often without outside or public scrutiny, and with at best minimal process of testing and certification. Boards of election and state-level authorities over election protocols have often accepted financial support from the equipment vendors and have also been seen at times to act under the influence of partisanship, appearing to elevate outcomes over fairness of process. Such systemic conflicts of interest do little to enhance the integrity or credibility of the vote-counting system. Computer experts have documented the susceptibility of both the recording and tabulating equipment to undetected errors, hacking, and deliberate fraud. A substantial component of the system, DREs, which are responsible for recording approximately 30% of the vote, generates no paper record and is effectively immune to meaningful recount. Central tabulators responsible for compiling over 50% of the vote employ an operating system that has been demonstrated to be vulnerable to entry and manipulation through a standard laptop PC. In spite of these vulnerabilities of the counting system, few, if any, questions about accuracy of the numbers it produced were raised on election night. On election night 2004, the exit polls and the vote counting equipment generated results that differed significantly. In the early morning of November 3, 2004, a CNN.com website screenshot entitled U.S. President National Exit Poll posted national exit poll results updated to 12:23 a.m., broken down by gender as well as a variety of other categories. The time of the update indicates that these results comprise substantially the full set of respondents polled on election day, but were free from the effects of a subsequent input of tabulated data used to bring about ultimate congruence between the exit poll and vote count results. The CNN posting indicates the number of respondents, 13,047, the gender breakdown of the sample, male 46%, female 54%, and the candidate preferences by gender, males 52% Bush, 47% Kerry, females 45% Bush, 54% Kerry. For the national exit poll taken as a whole, therefore, the result was 48.2% Bush, 50.8% Kerry. The vote counting equipment produced a markedly different result, 50.9% Bush, 48.1% Kerry. The differential between the two counts, which were virtually mirror images of each other, was 5.4% overall, or about 3.3 million votes. The reaction of election night analysts interpreting this differential was immediately to query what had gone wrong with the exit polls. This was a curious approach both in light of standard accounting practice, which compels independent examination of both sets of numbers that are found to be in conflict, and in light of much-voiced pre-election concerns about the accuracy and security of the computerized vote-counting systems. We offer an alternative approach to the conflicting data based on fundamental statistical and accounting principles. Stephen F. Freeman of the University of Pennsylvania has analyzed election 2004 exit poll results for battleground states and has drawn certain conclusions regarding the significant discrepancies between exit poll results and vote counts for several critical states. In particular, the odds against the discrepancies in Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania occurring together are computed at 662,000 to 1, or a virtual statistical impossibility that they could have been due to chance or random error. Receiving somewhat less emphasis is the overall pattern of discrepancy in the state polls. Again, with the vote counts turning in Bush's favor, though less dramatically, in the non-battleground states, as will be discussed below. The national popular vote is not addressed in that paper, but the same statistical principles are applicable and will be employed in this analysis. While the individual state samples totaled 73,678 reported respondents, a national subsampling was undertaken by Edison-Matofsky, which comprised 13,047 reported respondents, chosen as a representative random sample of the nation as a whole. This sample was drawn from 250 targeted polling places and from 500 individual telephone interviews with absentee and early voters. What is remarkable about this national sample of 13,047 is its size. When compared with more familiar pre-election poll samples of about 2,000 to 2,200 respondents, it is approximately 6 times as large. Such augmentation of sample size reduces a poll's margin of error from ±3%, to which we have been accustomed, to down to ±1.1%. The 1.1% margin of error tells us that barring specific flaws in the design or administration of the polls, and in the absence of significant mistabulation of the vote count itself, the exit poll result for the selected candidate will fall within 1.1% of his vote count 95% of the time. In this case, it tells us that we can be 95% certain that Kerry's popular vote percentage would fall in the range of 49.7% to 51.9%. That is, it would fall outside that range only 1 in 20 times. Kerry's reported vote count of 48.1% falls dramatically outside this range. To carry our analysis further, we can employ a normal distribution curve to determine, again, assuming proper poll methodology, no discriminatory voter suppression, and an accurate and honest popular vote count, that the probability that Kerry would have received his reported popular vote total of 48.1% or less is 1 in 959,000, a virtual statistical impossibility. We can proceed one helpful step further and calculate the likelihood, based on the exit poll results, that Kerry would receive more popular votes than Bush. The break-even point would be 59,024,629 votes, or 49.54% of the total. This percentage lies significantly outside the margin of error of the national exit poll, and in fact, we find that Kerry would receive fewer votes than Bush only 1.3% of the time. Put another way, given the exit poll results, proper poll methodology, and an accurate and fair voting process, Kerry would be the popular vote winner of election 2004, 98.7% of the time. The clear implication of our analysis is that neither chance nor random error is responsible for the significant incongruence of exit poll and tabulated vote results, and that we must look either to significant failings in the exit poll design and or administration, or to equally significant failings in the accuracy and or fairness of the voting process itself to explain the results. Given the dramatic implications of our analysis, we of course must consider carefully any argument that has been put forward suggesting that the exit polls failed as an accurate measure of voter intent. We examine the two least implausible hypotheses that have been put forward. The first deals with the proportion of respondents by gender. The composition of the national sample by gender was 46% male, 54% female, which prompted a claim that females were overrepresented, skewing the results toward Kerry. While it's not proven that this is in fact the case, if it is taken as stipulated and the sample is reweighted to reflect a, quote, normal gender breakdown of 52% female and 48% male, the effect is to increase Bush's exit poll percentage by 0.2% to 48.4% and decrease Kerry's to 50.6%. The effect on the bottom line is minimal. Kerry would be the popular vote victor 96.9% of the time. The second hypothesis put forward is the reluctant Bush responder hypothesis. It suggests that Bush voters were for some reason less willing to fill out an exit poll questionnaire and therefore were undercounted in the poll results. If such a phenomenon could be proven, it would be a source of significant skewing and effectively invalidate the polls. The proponents of this hypothesis, however, have yet to offer any supportive evidence for their theory. The hypothesis also does not explain the non-uniformity of the pattern of state-by-state discrepancies. In fact, one could equally well imagine a reluctant Kerry responder phenomenon was at work, and that the exit polls systematically underrepresented Kerry's vote. In light of the history of exit polling and the particular care that was taken to achieve an unprecedented degree of accuracy in the exit polls for election 2004, there is little to suggest significant flaws in the design or administration of the official exit polls. Until supportive evidence can be presented for any hypothesis to the contrary, it must be concluded that the exit polls, including the national mega-sample, within its 1.1% margin of error, present us with an accurate measure of the intent of the voters in the presidential election of 2004. According to this measure, an honest and fair voting process would have been more likely than not, at least 95% likely in fact, to have determined John Kerry to be the national popular vote winner of election 2004. Should ongoing or new investigations continue to produce evidence that votes have not been counted accurately and honestly, or that discriminatory vote suppression has occurred to an outcome determinative extent, the credibility of popular vote outcome may well be deemed relevant to the question of what remedies are warranted. And that was a report titled The 2004 Presidential Election, Who Won the Popular Vote? An Examination of the Comparative Validity of Exit Poll and Vote Count Data, released on December 28, 2004, and authored by Jonathan D. Simon, J.D., A Verified Vote, 2004, and Dr. Ron P. Bayman, Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thanks to the many people who contributed to tonight's program: Stephen Starr and Chris Burnett, Evan Davis, and Sean Ewald. I love you, Sean. Our theme music on Welcome Guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
We'll always be filled by unwelcome travelers.